The Iowa legislative session ended back in May, but many of the new laws took effect just this week. Are you aware of the changes that happened as of July? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, we listen back to a conversation IPR's Joyce Russell had with Democrat Mike Gronstahl and Republican Steve Lucan about the accomplishments of the session, what didn't get passed, and what legislative issues might be on tap for next year. Then in the second half hour, we'll talk about other new laws you might not be aware of. And at the end of the hour, we discuss several drownings in Iowa rivers yesterday and why rivers can be deceptive for swimmers. That's all coming up after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. While the Iowa legislature adjourned in May, many of the new laws didn't go into effect until earlier this week. Later in the program, we'll learn about some of them. But first, we listen back to a conversation soon after the legislature adjourned for the year. Iowa Public Radio legislative correspondent Joyce Russell spoke with Republican Steve Lucan, the assistant majority leader in the Iowa House, and with Senate Majority Leader Mike Gronstahl, a Democrat. They talked about what was passed this year, what didn't get done, and what might be on tap for next year's legislative session. Joyce Russell began by asking Senator Gronstahl what legislative accomplishments he would take to voters this fall.
Well, I think our focus from the start of the session was all about creating jobs in the state of Iowa and matching workers' skills to the jobs that are available out there. So we thought very important that we focus on providing training and education for workers in the state of Iowa. So I think we had pretty significant accomplishments in the area of community colleges and higher education. And that's most of the studies suggest that what Iowa lacks isn't workers. It's workers with the right skills to match the jobs that are available out there. So so our investment in community colleges is part of helping workers' skills match the positions that are available.
And Republicans didn't roll over and play dead and say yes to that right away.
Well, they certainly didn't. The House budget cut higher education both for our state universities and for our community colleges, and the governor's budget itself on community colleges was in fact a cut. It was a small operating increase, but then a significant reduction in training dollars. So we were able in the end to prevail about 28, 29 million new dollars for community colleges and about 23 million for our Regents institutions.
Representative Lucan, why did your party fight those increases for the community colleges so hard?
Well, I wouldn't say that we fought them. I think there was many people in our caucus who were believers in the community college system, and I would actually echo what the senator said, that we do see a need for the skilled workers. When you look at where the job picture is at in the state of Iowa, there's a lot of jobs in the construction and manufacturing fields that the community colleges are a great pipeline to help people get into those types of skilled trades. Primarily, though, we wanted to start out the budgeting process making sure we were not going to spend more than we took in. And that forces you to make some hard decisions. And we had to put a proposal on the table to the Senate, which we did, which probably spent around 97-98% of the available revenue. And at the end of the day, we were able to create a budget that will spend about 99% of the available ongoing revenue, doesn't dip into special accounts, really puts the state on a firm financial footing. And that is a big issue for us in terms of job creation, because we want to be able to let the business community know, let Iowans know, you are in a state that is in strong fiscal health. We're in it's a stable place to grow. It's a stable place to invest, versus looking at other states like Illinois, where there's serious budget troubles and constant kind of issues with tax increases and things like that. We wanted to have a stable environment for Iowans to grow in.
And your party also promised jobs on the first day of the session. So besides a balanced budget, which you are saying is part of the job attraction picture, what else did you do to create jobs?
Well, we think that, again, that is a very big piece, making sure there is stable funding for the state, and we're on a solid financial footing. I think we did some good work in terms of the regulatory environment with reviewing state rules, making sure that state rules are getting reviewed every 5 years, and we aren't putting onerous regulations on the business community. The community college piece, I think, is important to many people. We also passed some bills, for example, the ESOP, Employee Stock Option Program, that will help companies stay in Iowa when a company's maybe a founder is deciding to move or sell their company. This is actually a program that will help us keep those companies here in Iowa and allow the employees to buy them and help the employees buy them and keep those jobs and companies here in the state of Iowa. I think we also did some interesting pieces of legislation, one that was very important for my area up in northeast Iowa, and hopefully it helps the entire state, is the Field of Dreams legislation that creates a sales tax rebate similar to the Newton Racetrack. That has the potential to bring about $40 million of new spending into the state each year. And, we focused a lot on those types of opportunities and tried to seize them when we could.
And you mentioned reviewing all state rules every 5 years. Did that actually pass both houses of the legislature?
I believe that was part of the final package. I'd have to pull my end of session fact sheet out again, but
yes, it was. It was okay. part of, I believe, the standings bill at the very end. We certainly had discussions about that, and Democrats in the Senate certainly supported a review. There were some people that wanted an automatic repeal of rules, rules that protect public health and safety probably shouldn't be automatically repealed, but a review of rules certainly made sense, and we went along with that.
And Senator Gronstahl, one more question about job creation before we move on. You know, I think it's 89,000 Iowans still out of work. Used to be at the height of the recession, more than 100,000. I think the average person hearing this is going to say, oh, okay, well, maybe training more workers is a good thing to do, but that's going to take a while to kick in. And
well,
and did you really do enough to put people back to work?
Well, I think in one sense, we probably never do enough. But we work through a host of issues. We passed a number of bills that are kind of sitting in the House that they wouldn't go along with. We wanted a bill that would help small businesses, give them a tax credit for health insurance. But if you look at the studies out there, and there was a study released in January that said over the next 7 years in Iowa, there'll be about a half million new jobs created, and 300,000 of those jobs, three-fifths of those new jobs, will need more than a high school diploma but less than a four-year degree. That's why we thought it was so critically important that we provide training money and additional resources to community colleges to match the jobs. There are literally thousands of jobs in the state of Iowa that are open right now, and there aren't the skilled workers to fill those jobs. So upscaling workers' skills to match the jobs that are needed in the 21st century is critically important. That's why we had a very strong focus on community colleges.
Well, both parties said that cutting commercial property taxes was one way to create new jobs in the future. And as we all know, the legislature failed to do that. In a nutshell, Republicans wanted permanent property tax relief without regard to future legislatures' ability to compensate local governments for their losses, and they wanted limits on local government spending to rein in property tax increases in the future. Democrats wanted to give tax credit to businesses when the state could afford to compensate for the losses. And in the end, Senator Gronstahl, some of your Senate Democrats couldn't go along with that. They said that's too big a hit on the state treasury. To me, it's not a surprise that Democrats would make that argument. These arguments have been made on both of these sides for years. To me, the surprising thing was how many of your caucus members were willing to go as far as they did to cut property taxes, even though it would cost the state treasury and potentially leave other priorities unfunded, like education or public safety. Why would you say most of your caucus members were willing to do that?
Well, first of all, I'd say the Democrats were willing to create permanent tax relief if if the governor was willing to commit to permanent reimbursement for what local governments lost. And it's not because of the local governments. It's because if you don't cover the losses, there is a gigantic tax shift. The House bill and the governor's bill and recommendation, in our mind, was the biggest tax shift in the history of the state of Iowa. It loaded up taxes on homeowners, and if the state provided the resources for local governments, then that wouldn't create the tax shift. Our state treasury has about $1 billion in it. $600 million of that is in reserve funds, and we figured now was the time for the state to take over more of the cost of local governments by commercial property taxes by replacing the lost funds. But if we don't replace them, homeowners are going to get gouged. And that was something Senate Democrats simply couldn't go along with.
And Senator Lucan, what is your, in a nutshell, what's the Republican response to that, that if you don't compensate local governments for these losses, they're either going to have to cut services or they're going to pass those costs back on to another class of property, namely homeowners? What's your strongest argument against that?
If you look at all of the nonpartisan analysis of the property tax situation in Iowa, and it is amazingly complex. I'm not going to pretend I'm an expert, but the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency, under every scenario that the House passed, we passed four reform bills in the last 2 years, local government's revenues grew. There's a lot of talk about reductions in revenue. What we actually effectively did under our proposals is slowed the growth or reduced the amount of growth. For example, the last bill we passed right now, homeowners can see a cap of 4% growth per year. This would actually reduce that down to 3%. So it slowed the growth, and that was something we felt was very important. We felt that it was important to actually try to help all classes of property payers. And, you know, our bills, we tried to send what we thought were measured proposals over to the Senate. We sent, again, four plans in the last couple of years. And we tried to also actually effectively reduce what people, the checks they wrote, because we tried to pay for more things like more school aid out of the state general fund. So we wanted relief. And we also, I think we had a pretty reasonable rollback that was added to the commercial side. The last bill we sent over took it from 100% of commercial being taxed 100% down to 90%. And we felt there was relief in all classes of property in those bills.
Well, I think
And I would say we agreed with many of those concepts. We really did. And we were more than willing to do that. But the House bill, as written, if there was a $1 increase in the local value of commercial property, they got no reimbursement from the state. What that means is there's a gigantic tax shift to homeowners.
Okay.
And that's the part that was completely unacceptable to Senate Democrats.
All right. And I think we've given a little object lesson here of why this problem remains unresolved. And I want each of you to answer very briefly. Tell me why we should ever expect that this legislature is going to reach agreement on commercial property taxes as long as it's a divided legislature. Representative Lucan.
We were close. We were close this last session, and I think it's very important to Iowans. Iowans routinely bring this up as a big issue, and it's a big issue in terms of job creation. So I think the pressure will be on the campaign trail to get people to do something.
And Senator Gronsall, as long as it's a divided legislature, why should I think that this is ever going to get resolved?
Well, I think eventually some folks will come to their senses and say a tax shift to homeowners isn't the solution, and that the solution is for the state to take some of our ample surplus and use that to lower commercial property taxes. We are relatively high on commercial property taxes in the state of Iowa, and that is an impact on job creation in our state. Probably not as big as some people would suggest, but it's real, and it exists, and I think we ought to do something about it. But if it's going to be a tax shift to homeowners, we're going to continue to fight that and stand up for homeowners.
It's River to River on Iowa Public Radio. We're talking about the legislative session just adjourned. Senator Mike Gronsdahl and Representative Steve Lucan are our guests. Do you have an opinion about something the legislature did or didn't do this year? Join us at 866-780-9100 or by email at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Among the governor's education proposals, as you know, only a handful were approved. Beefed up reading in the early grades, annual teacher evaluations, competency-based education. A much longer list wasn't approved, making it easier to fire ineffective teachers. End of course exams as a graduation requirement. Now, as you both know, an even more controversial and expensive item, and that's revamping how teachers' salaries are done, was taken off the table this year, but the governor says he'll press for that next year. Briefly, Representative Lucan and then Senator Gronstahl, what next steps will your caucus be willing to take next year on education reform?
Well, I think that the focus on the early grades reading is something I heard a lot of House education members talking about, because those are the key times, my understanding, is when you can catch those students who are having trouble in the earlier grades. If you get that fixed early, it makes them much more able to be successful down the road. So those, I think, are the goals, the early years of education. But I also think the quality of teachers in the classroom will be something that will be discussed, both in terms of hiring practices, but also in terms of pay. You know, we talked for several years about trying to get – there's some wonderful people who are out there who cannot get into the teaching profession because of the salary gap. When you have somebody who's in the engineering field or science field, trying to get them to come into the classroom can make it difficult. But likewise, there's people who have an ability and a desire to step in and serve as a teacher. Maybe they've at the end of their career in the private sector, and I think we ought to make it a little bit easier to get people into the teaching career as well.
And Senator Gronstahl, what steps is your caucus going to be willing to take next year?
Well, one of the things we did at the end was agreed to create a reading institute or a literacy center. I'm not sure exactly what it's going to be called, but in the Department of Education, to identify kind of best practices in terms of helping kids that are lagging in their literacy skills. So I also think identifying best practices, the next step is to make sure local school districts have the resources to do things like provide summer school programs to students that are lagging, or mentoring or coaching, or after school programs, those kinds of things. And those things don't just happen. We'll have to provide the resources to local school districts. So we look to partner with school districts on making sure that every kid can read by the end of the third grade. And so I think next year, after having a year kind of under their belt at the Department of Education, to develop some recommendations as to what best practices are for helping lagging readers, I think it behooves the legislature to then provide the resources to get the kinds of programs out there to local school districts that need that.
As we know, there was no action on raising the gasoline tax. I'm wondering, was there ever any real chance that the legislature was going to raise gasoline taxes in an election year? Let's try to run through several questions and keep our answers short, because we're almost out of time. Representative Lucan?
I think the answer is yes. There were a number of interested members on both chambers, both sides of the aisle. Obviously, it is a difficult issue, and we have a number of people also who are very opposed to raising any tax, but I think it is an issue of job creation. We have a lot of construction companies in the state who would love to be out doing more work and hiring people. So I think it's something that you'll probably hear a lot about on the campaign trail.
And Senator Gronstahl, how significant is it that the two lawmakers who put forth the bill to raise gasoline taxes, Democrat Tom Riley and Republican Dave Jepkes, they're both leaving the legislature?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that has much significance. That's probably more a function of redistricting and the kind of look of the maps. I'd say the legislature took a look at the economy, took a look at the price of gas, and said, now's not the time. I think the legislature made the right decision. We took a look at the situation and said, we do need more resources for our transportation system in this state, but now's not the time to load up additional taxes on Iowa citizens in the middle of the economy and when there's still almost 90,000 people out of work in this state.
Moving on to some social issues, abortion restrictions, expanded gun rights, reversing same-sex marriage rights. Representative Lucan, how aggressively those are all, were all passed by the House and not taken up by the Senate. How aggressively will Republicans campaign on those issues?
Well, I think it's probably a race-by-race issue. There are obviously some areas of the state where that is a major focus. There are some areas where it is not. You know, our members were proud of the votes we took. We felt we were listening to the voters. So that will be an issue, I guess, in a race-by-race basis.
And Senator Gronstahl, will your caucus make the case to voters that a Democratic Senate is the last bulwark against those issues?
I always say people want to kind of read into legislative campaigns a whole bunch of things. And in the end, it is individual districts in individual parts of the state, 50 Senate districts, where the voters make a choice as to who they think can best represent them in the legislature. And it has little to do with those high-profile issues. It's people making a judgment who's a leader in our community, who will do a good job representing us there. You can't agree with everybody 100% of the time. I only agree with my wife 90% of the time. The other 10%, I assume I'm wrong. So that's the reality. These elections will be about local people knocking on doors, connecting with their voters, and making the case that they can represent them well in the legislature.
Representative Lucan, how disappointed is your caucus that the Senate didn't take up the nuclear power bill?
Well, there were many members who were very interested in seeing that issue advance. But again, I think it's another issue that we were happy with our vote. We think it's an issue we need to go out and talk to Iowans about. We are in a situation currently where we really need to start looking at increasing our energy production in the state. We want to be looking long term and making sure we have reliable, safe energy that's affordable. And I think that's something that, again, ties back to the economy and jobs. And so I think it's an issue that many Iowans are going to be interested in talking to their candidates about.
And very briefly, Senator, why didn't you take up the nuclear power bill?
Well, I think in the end, the judgment in the Senate was there were not enough protections for consumers built into that bill, and we couldn't find consensus on how to protect consumers. The House bill let them pay for the plant up front, and with no guarantee that the plant had ever be finished. So there were real concerns with the way the House bill was structured and its protection for consumers.
Kathy in Iowa City writes, okay, so why public money for the private dam at Delhi that impacts so few people, and why no public money for Chicago-Omaha Rail, which impacts far more people and has far more reaching economic impact and job creation? Senator Gronstahl, very briefly.
Well, I'd say the Senate was supportive of passenger rail, and we'd like to see it not just get to Iowa City all the way to Omaha. So us folks out here in western Iowa are served by it as well.
I'm going to have to cut you off there. And Representative Lucan on that money issue?
Very briefly, that actually saves taxpayers money because we would otherwise have to backfill dollars into the area under the education spending. And this will make a huge impact in northeast Iowa economically.
IPR legislative correspondent Joyce Russell speaking earlier this year after the end of the legislative session with Republican Steve Lucan, the assistant majority leader in the Iowa House, and with Senate Majority Leader Mike Gronstahl, a Democrat. Coming up, we'll find out about some of the laws that passed the session and took effect this week. Also, yesterday, July 4th, three children drowned in the Iowa River in Marshalltown. We'll talk with Marshalltown Police Chief Mike Tooper about the tragedy and how rivers can be deceptive when they are low. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Over the noon hour, I'm Ben Kiefer. The Iowa legislative session ended back in May, but many of the new laws took effect just this week with the beginning of July. And in the next few minutes, we want to learn more about some specific changes. First, throughout this year's legislative session, Iowa City restaurateur Kurt Michael Fries spearheaded a movement dubbed Raise the Bar. Now, this called on Iowa lawmakers to update some pre-prohibition era features of the state's liquor law. Kurt Michael Fries joins us by phone For the next few minutes, he's the owner and founding chef of Devotee in Iowa City, also publisher of Edible, the Iowa River Valley magazine. Chef Fries, welcome.
Hi, Ben. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. So what can you and other restaurateurs now legally do that you couldn't do before?
Well, essentially what we can do is we can keep the things that we make in our bars for up to 3 days. That's a very simple, short answer. It used to be true that anything that was mixed, as soon as it came out of its original container in any way, had to be served immediately. But now we're allowed to keep them for up to 3 days. That makes it possible to, for example, mix a batch of sangria up to 3 gallons and store it rather than making the sangria fresh every day. For the Mexican restaurants that have those big vats of margaritas, they can have those things and keep them for more than the one business day. It's not everything we were trying for in the original proposed legislation, but it's a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. This is the broad term for these are infused drinks. Name some other drinks this includes.
Right. Well, that is a bit of a misconception there, really, because infused alcohol and bitters and things are what we were trying to make. But most of those things, say a raspberry infused vodka, for example, or a limoncello, those things take anywhere from a couple of weeks to a couple of months of just sitting on the shelf and infusing their flavors to taste good. So we're still not allowed to do that yet, and I hope to down the road adjust that and get the legislation further along.
I hear that in your voice that 3 days and 3 gallons is a far cry from what you and the Iowa Restaurant Association were hoping for in this Raise the Bar campaign. True?
Yes. Well, I'm glad you mentioned the Iowa Restaurant Association. They were a tremendous help in this legislation. We were hoping for more, but we're happy with what we got. We hope to take it further in the future. I know there were those who felt that what we were proposing was some sort of a crack in Iowa's three-tier system, the alcohol legislation that rules that keep producers apart from wholesalers, apart from retailers.
Mm-hmm.
You're not allowed to be any combination of those. You can only be in one segment of it. And they thought that our producing these things took us over into the producer section on top of being a retailer. I argue that that's not the case because there's no fermentation involved, there's no distillation involved, there's no packaging for resale off-premises involved. All we're doing is, in essence, mixing a cocktail and then asking to keep it for a longer period of time than the new legislation allows.
So your opposition came from, what would you guess, the alcohol producers, the alcohol production industry?
Well, the only folks that ever registered with the state as lobbyists have to do for being for or against or neutral or anything like that. The only ones who said anything who registered against it were the Iowa beer wholesalers.
Okay, so where
to? They're the ones I believe anyway who thought that it was a crack in the three-tier system.
Uh-huh. This 3 days and 3 gallons compromise or step in what you would call the right direction was arrived at how?
Through lots of consultation with the Alcoholic Beverages Division, who was also very cooperative in all of this, a couple of Senate subcommittees and such, and then it got into the what they call the standings bill at the last minute, thanks to Senator Rick Bertrand out of Sioux City.
Okay, Chef Kurt Michael Fries, thank you very much. We'll look forward to seeing what you're going to push there for the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
And as we're talking about new laws in most of our program today, the session ended back in May. Many new laws took effect just this week. And now we want to turn to the new rules of the road that drivers will need to know. Joining us to do that, Dave Stutz. He's executive officer with the Iowa Department of Transportation. Good afternoon to you, Dave.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Let's go through these. Concerning school buses, what do we need to know now as drivers passing school buses that has changed?
Well, the legislature was very concerned about a tragic incident that happened back in May of 2011 in North Iowa. And young Caden Halverson was a 7-year-old elementary grade student who was attempting to board a school bus, and a motorist failed to obey the flashing red lights on the bus struck Caden, and unfortunately she lost her life.
Mm-hmm. And so this is being then called Caden's Law. What does it do?
Caden's Law, and as a matter of fact, this went into effect. It had an early enactment clause on it, so it went into effect on March 16th of 2012. And basically what it does is enhance the penalties for failing to obey school bus warning and stop signals. And the first offense fine was more than doubled. It carries a fine now of $250 up to $675. And also the court can order imprisonment for up to 30 days. So you could have the fine as well as the imprisonment. Second offense carries an $1,875 fine. But it went another step further. The bill went and it impacted the statute that provides for penalties for violations resulting in injury or death. So if you disobey the law around the school bus and you do serious injury to a student, the fine increases by another $500 plus 90 days of your driver's license being suspended.
Mm-hmm.
Because of death, there's another $1,000 added to it, and then your driver's license is suspended for 180 days.
How much of this do you think is just awareness raising that some people do not know how to behave around a school bus when it's stopped?
I think that's true, but I think that we cannot overlook the distraction factor. Motorists today can be distracted by a multitude of things, and probably the most prevalent that we've been hearing about now is the electronic communication devices.
Texting or cell phones.
Texting and talking on the phone. And I think all your listeners need to know is that it is illegal to read or send text messages while driving in Iowa, any driver. Cell phone use is still permitted except for the young drivers that are on the subject to GDL.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot use cell phones. So I think distraction certainly has a factor in this. Even if not using the electronic devices, maybe preoccupied with the things that are going on and just not thinking, oh, I have to do something here.
Right.
It's kind of hard to think of that because a big yellow school bus with flashing lights is pretty hard to miss.
You said flashing lights. Now, these are the red flashing lights with the extended stop sign. What if the bus is stopped, and I've seen drivers not know what to do in this situation, a stopped bus with children on it, flashing yellow lights, no extended mm-hmm. stop sign. How do you proceed there?
Well, let's set the environment here. We'll say you're just on your standard two-way highway or two-way street. If you come up behind the bus and the flashing yellows are on, you must stop. Okay, if you're coming towards the bus, you've got to reduce your speed and be prepared for the red light to come on and the stop arm to come out. And then you stop and you wait until the stop arm comes in.
Mm-hmm.
So that's on a two-way highway, and you could even apply that to oftentimes, especially in city environments, you see, oh, well, we have a three-way thing here. We've got traffic to the left side, traffic to the right side, and then a left turn lane in the center. Same rules apply.
Okay. Sounds like a lot of detail there that people can refresh themselves with as far as knowing the idea. Give us a website that people can find out about how we behave around school buses safely.
You can just simply go to the Iowa DOT's website. It's easy to get to, www.iowadot.gov.
Okay. Another law we wanted to get to, the move-over law. Explain what's new there.
Well, this one was impacted again by another rather tragic incident. You may recall back in September of 2011 on Interstate 80 in Poweshiek County, there was a towing recovery specialist truck out on the highway aiding a disabled semi. Two workers were killed when another truck slammed into them. So Iowa has had a move-over law since 2002. But what the legislature decided is that penalties, again, needed to be increased. Now, let's talk a little bit about what move over means. If you're coming down the highway or the roadway and you see a vehicle that is a stationary vehicle that is performing an authorized function, now that could be a towing vehicle, could be a utility maintenance truck, could be a DOT maintenance, highway construction, emergency medical vehicle, an ambulance, or law enforcement. The law says that you have to slow down, and if possible, when passing, you must change lanes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, changing lanes isn't always legal. It isn't always safe. But if that's the case, you must slow down to a reasonable and proper speed, which is less than the posted speed limit for that environment, and then safely pass by.
To be clear, just as far as the law goes, while it may be wise to do that slow down and move over maneuver for just a car with its hazard lights on, that is not what the law stipulates here. We are talking about some car flashing lights, an official tow truck, police car, etc.
That's correct. But I would agree with you that one should exercise the same amount of care for a car with its hazard lights on.
A couple of other odds and ends. I understand a provision to allow drivers' license renewal online was included in the government efficiencies bill, but vetoed by the governor, Governor Branstad, not because he opposes allowing drivers' license renewal online, but because he didn't think the bill went far enough in making the government more efficient. Is this something the Iowa DOT will attempt to get passed next year?
Yes, we're very much interested in providing this enhanced service to Iowans. We have 2.1 million drivers in Iowa, and we're in the age now where folks like to do things electronically. We can do it now safely and without jeopardizing identity and security. So we very much want to do this. We sought the enabling language, but unfortunately the bill didn't pass the governor's scrutinization. But we'll be back next year, and we're optimistic that we can get it through.
How much of a benefit would that have in terms of efficiency, you think?
Well, you know, folks don't like to come and stand in line for services, and we're very much concerned about that. So it gives people the opportunity every other renewal cycle, folks that have a good driving record, to do it online, and we think that that's going to save them time, and it saves them money in the sense that they don't have to take time off from work or whatever to come to a DL station. And there may be a small convenience fee that's attached to it, but the price of the license is not going to wouldn't go up.
Now, another point, another law which passed allows the DOT to waive commercial drivers' licensing skills tests for veterans who have operated commercial equipment.
That's correct. The legislature saw fit, and they had the authority to do this based on federal regulations, because the federal government actually regulates the commercial driver's license program in the states. And for a driver to get a CDL, commercial driver's license, they must take knowledge tests and they must take skills tests. And skills tests are the driving portion of the test.
Mm-hmm.
And no one can be waived the knowledge test. Everybody has to take those. However, the federal regulations allows the states to pass statutes or regulations that waives the driving portion of the test, providing a military person has 2 years of experience in operating heavy vehicles. And if they're still in the military, we can consider those individual servicemen. Or if they're just recently released, discharged from the service within the last 90 days with an honorable discharge, we can waive those skills tests, which the legislature is confident that that's going to help ease their transition into civilian employment.
Okay, Dave Stutz with the Iowa Department of Transportation updating us on some new laws, some new rules of the road. Thank you, Dave Stutz.
You're welcome.
And finally this hour, tragedies marking this year's Independence Day in Iowa. Authorities, as you've heard in the news, have recovered the body of a 31-year-old woman from the West Nishnabotna River near Cold Springs Park in the southwest part of the state. A separate tragedy yesterday, the Marshalltown Police Department responded to an area of the Iowa River near Riverview Park in Marshalltown after it had been reported that three children were missing after a search and rescue operation. It lasted a couple of hours. The bodies of three children were recovered from the water. Joining us now by phone, Marshalltown Police Chief Mike Tooper. Gut-wrenching to hear this, especially with children. Police Chief Tooper, who were the children who died?
The names of the children are Lee May. She was a female child, age 9. Her brother, Say Ray, age 7. And their cousin, Ty Mo, also age 7, of all of Marshalltown, passed away yesterday.
Now I understand your investigation continues about the circumstances that led to the drowning. What can you tell us at this point?
Well, we're still trying to piece together, you know, what happened and the circumstances surrounding this. You know, it's as everybody knows, it's been very hot, and people are looking for ways to cool off, and I think, you know, some family members here thought this was a good opportunity yesterday afternoon to be down by the river and have some recreation time with family and do some fishing and to be in the water, which I certainly understand. And unfortunately, we had these tragic results.
Mm-hmm. I understand about a dozen families were on the shores of the river yesterday in Marshalltown, and they saw the three children go under.
Yeah.
The family, I understand from reports, immigrants from the Southeast Asian country of Myanmar. The children went under, were never seen. They had come to fish and swim in the river.
Mm-hmm.
What questions will you want to be answering in this investigation? Can you share some of that with us?
Well, right now we're just trying to determine, you know, what led up to the event and who was there and what everybody witnessed. All indications right now is this was a tragic accident, and it's really important that you know, we not blame anybody for what happened. This could have happened to anybody. The area of the river that they're at, parts of it is very shallow, and I think to some degree that's giving people a false sense of security, because, you know, they're out in the river and maybe it's only ankle to knee deep and they think it's safe. But they can be walking along and then end up in a very deep area of the river and not even realize it until it's too late.
What we don't know and that you can tell us about, and then you know very well, is that, yeah, as you said, the bed of a river can be very uneven and
right.
Can drop off how fast?
Instantaneously. I mean, you can go from ankle-deep water to 12 feet of water very easily. And because of the nature of a river, the water is very murky, very difficult to see the bottom anyway, so you're not always going to see these deep holes. And unfortunately, when you get into the deeper water, there can also be a very difficult undertow or undercurrent that may not even be visible at the surface. And so the water at the surface looks very calm, but once you get into the deeper water, there's an undercurrent that can be very difficult to navigate, even if you're an experienced swimmer.
Mm-hmm. So we should not draw the conclusion, because our rivers are very low, as all Iowa rivers are this year at this time, that they are any less dangerous.
Absolutely. You know, I think we have to be cautious with rivers in general. I would not recommend using rivers for recreational swimming. I think, you know, the weather's been very hot and humid, and people are looking for ways to cool off, which I certainly understand. And there has been a false sense of security, because it appears that the water levels are low. But there's many areas of the Iowa River and every other river in the state where it can be shallow and then get very deep very quickly.
And yet, as you acknowledged, it's a tradition in Iowa to swim in rivers, and people are looking to cool off. Are you saying that swimming in rivers is never a good idea? How do we judge that?
Well, I'm certainly not an expert about swimming in rivers. I'll tell you what I tell my children, and the advice I give to other people is I don't feel comfortable in using a river as for recreational swimming. Because of the undercurrents and because of the varying depths, it can be very challenging, even for people that are experienced and strong swimmers. And when you have people that maybe don't have a lot of experience swimming in difficult currents, or you have people that have limited swimming skills, it can be a very dangerous thing to do.
Okay. Well, and thank you very much for this conversation. Mike Tupper joining us, Marshalltown Police Chief. Again, recapping, you've heard it in the news. Yesterday, Marshalltown Police responded to an area of the Iowa River in town near Riverview Park. Three children missing, as it turns out, tragically. The bodies of the three children were recovered from the water. Do be safe getting cooling off this very hot summer. Police Chief Tupper, thank you for joining us.
No problem. Thank you, sir.
River to River is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins with technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River available at iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.